October to the evening of Monday, April 30th, 7 p.m. Work session on Act 2048, 2804, 2895, 2726, 2997, 2005, 2713, 2016.
We're back in order. An officer. The chairperson, perhaps for the record, I ought to repeat just so we're
clear. Yeah,
I'm Steve Kelfer. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities. Mr. Edstrom and I, in a telephone conversation last week, reached conceptual agreements. We each drafted some proposed amendments. What you have before you tonight is based on a kind of a merger of those two concepts with some assistance of Mr. Kopetsky. And I think perhaps for the record it would be useful to go through the hand and ghost version you have in front of you so that we can clearly understand what we're working with. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill would remain intact. Simply naming the
Chairman, may I ask a question? Right off the bat, this section 2, is this necessary?
And I suspect
not. Do we really need that line in the statute?
I suspect not, and that's exactly what it'll do. It'll disappear. That's kind of a line in Chapter 243 somewhere after the codifiers are done
with
it.
Well, I'll get back to that. Go ahead, Steve.
Incidentally, the reference in Section 1 is to Chapter 243, and I must point out that 243 does cover several things in addition to just the collective bargaining, so that's probably an appropriate reference. Section 3, we're recommending a modification in the definition of disciplinary action along the same line that I suggested the other day during hearing by deleting the language in the action, so on and so forth, so that discipline would simply be defined very clearly: dismissal, demotion, suspension with pay, reduction in salary, written reprimand, or transfer. Then you'll note we've added a new subsection 3 defining just cause. It could mean a violation of the public employer's policy, work rule, or regulation, which can be reasonably supported by substantial evidence. Section 4, we're recommending deletion of the language unless the officer is notified, and substituting without just cause, so that we'd read no disciplinary action shall be taken against a police officer without just cause. And then we're setting out, without just cause is a term that we dwelt on for a while. Now, how do you interpret, or where else do you point to that language in the statute so we can get an idea of what it means?
Well, we've defined just cause right above.
Right.
Okay, so that we're just what we're talking about is just as it's defined in this statute.
The record should, Mr. Chairman, hopefully reflect the fact that the intent of that your will would be that just cause is as defined here in the statute. I think it's a fairly clear piece of language which spells out the test. Mr. Edstrom might want to comment on that. And I think that's an ample job of providing an opportunity for anybody to one, get the court, if you will, and then once there have the effect of due process.
Okay,
in subsection 2, we're recommending the deletion of the language that has been stricken and setting it up so it would read as follows: a public employer that intends to take disciplinary action shall, colon, and then two paragraphs, paragraph A, notify the police officer of the charges against the officer and the proposed disciplinary action. That would comport with the Hammer decision. And then paragraph B, provide the police officer with an opportunity to respond to the charges at an informal hearing, which may be recorded with the person or persons having authority to impose the proposed disciplinary action. That also designed to comport with the Supreme Court decision on due process. I want to underscore for you the fact that that language includes the word informal hearing. I think it's very important that the record show that that's the intent here, and the reason I bring that to your attention is that for very small cities, what I was concerned about initially in the first draft of the bill was a potential for litigation over any disciplinary action, which later might well have been interpreted by the courts as a full-blown evidentiary hearing. And I think that qualifier, that it be an informal hearing, is extremely critical for the
purpose of the bill. Okay, now, one step further now, where it says, which may be recorded. Would that be under joint agreement, or could either party initiate and demand that it be recorded?
If I could ask that, Mr. Chairman, I'm Dave Edson. That would be at the option of either party, and I think that's in keeping with the present Oregon Public Meetings Law, which allows either party to make it, allows the employee to make it open to the public if he wishes. Otherwise, it's ordinarily held in executive session that is a personnel action.
Right. Okay.
Particularly permissive, but would afford an opportunity for a police officer who probably wanted to develop a record for subsequent appeal to do so.
Okay. Could the employer demand that it be recorded?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure.
Here we go. Chairman, sure. Now, when you say recorded, does that mean executive session versus open session, open hearing, or does that mean literally recorded?
Well, I'll let Mr. Edson answer. In my terminology, I think I could see that as perhaps somewhat vague, where it could mean recording by minutes under as per open meeting law. And of course, again, the open meeting law may or may not pertain depending on who it was that was holding the hearing. If it was the governing body or a majority or quorum of the governing body, then clearly that would be the case. If it was a police chief or a city manager, then the open meeting law would not come into play.
if it is a formal, before the city council, then under other provisions of the statute, the police officer could request a closed hearing.
Yes.
But the city cannot request a closed hearing.
If my memory is open.
I'm relating that to the school board. That's what works the school board in. I think another matter is personnel. A disciplinary matter is at the request of the person who is having the hearing, or the hearing is being held about, may request that it be an open.
Correct. It's a spring open rather than spring closed. It would be an executive session by definition under the open meeting law, but the grievance would have the capacity to request that it be open.
Okay. So that's when you say here it may be recorded. I take that literally as whatever means a recorder, note, whatever.
Transcription.
That's what I was thinking. Mr. Chairman, Representative Rogers, that's the way it is intended, the literal, not to conflict with the open meeting law.
Okay.
It is.
You made a remark there that made me wonder.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
Chairman? I just had a real problem with that informal. I mean, you made a very strong case that that must be that way, and I just think it ought to be the other way around and equally as strong, that officer's protection.
Well, again, my fear, Representative Starr, is that in very small cities, and being realistic about it, those are the kinds of political subdivisions this bill is most likely to affect, because most middle or larger sized cities already have processes which would be exempted under this statute. I just can't see placing upon those very small city councils, for example, a burden of having a perhaps an independent hearing officer and a full-blown what could be an evidentiary hearing. It just seems way beyond what's required.
But you're laying on an informal hand disciplinary action which includes dismissal. And that is a pretty darn strong charge, and it's a strong penalty, it's a strong discipline, and I think that officer ought to have more than just an informal thing which may be recorded. I don't think that's anywhere near strong enough.
Well, it's only the Supreme Court of the United States has indicated that an informal hearing is all that's required on a pre-dismissal basis.
And the other thing that bothers me is in this new three, the word policy. I can see a violation of a work rule or a regulation which would probably be printed in some kind of a document, but a policy would be something that would just be determined at the whim of an official. Maybe it isn't in the police business, but it sure is in the railroad business.
Again, Representative, if I might, generally a public employee's policy would refer to a personnel manual adopted by a resolution of the governing body or an ordinance. And you'll find in the public sector those are usually pretty well nailed down in writing. Section 5, we're attempting to, since it would be redundant to again refer back to just cause, we're simply sticking subsection 1 and replace it with language to read this 1979 Act does not apply to disciplinary action taken, and then recited the same A, B, C, D as originally set forth in the bill. That pretty well, I think, Mr. Chairperson, describes the changes that we've recommended. And it's my understanding that both parties are in agreement here on this language.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Now, Roger.
Between A and B, should we have a conjunction, because we do mean and?
That's correct, yeah.
Good point.
Okay. So after the word disciplinary action, there should be the word and after the comma.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not or.
Good point, right. Very good.
Mr. Chairman?
What's up, Rogers?
I'd move that House Bill 2997 be amended by the proposed amendments headed by CALFOR AOC/LOC dated 4/27/79, which corresponds to the hand-engraved copy that we have.
Okay, you've heard the motion. Any discussion at all?
I just want to know if the police officers like this amendment.
Yes, sir.
I'd move the House Bill 2997 be amended to delete Section 2 on lines 5 and 6, and that the sections 3, 4, and 5 be appropriately renumbered.
Okay, that should at least be reference to the act being known, and maybe settled as the police officer's Bill of Rights.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason for that is that it's just going to have no meaning at all in the statute. It's going to occupy a section in the statute book.
Any discussion on that?
I think that typically fit in there, but you can ask them why they want it in there.
Any comments? Go ahead.
It was put in intentionally as a short title reference point, as I see many bills have, for example, I believe it was last session, the Abuse Prevention Act, a short title, and it's not intended as a statement of anything, it's more of a reference, that's all it is.
My objection would be, though, that it doesn't really affect all police officers and their rights. If it was something comprehensive that would affect that a broader group, then I would certainly consider that. I like those titles and things.
Like ERA.
Oh, right.
Right. Is there any further discussion on the matter to delete section 2? Clerk Colwell.
Johnson.
Aye.
Tafari.
Aye.
Weevil.
Aye.
Bryson.
Aye.
Shaw.
Aye.
Rogers.
Aye.
Press.
No.
I didn't
love it, Joe. No.
Representative Rogers.
I'd move House Bill 2997 as amended to the floor with the due pass and let it be printed in gross.
Okay. Heard the motion. Clerk Colwell.
Johnson.
Aye.
Tafari.
Aye.
Weevil.
Aye.
Bryson.
Aye.
Shaw.
Aye.
Rogers.
Aye.
Press.
Aye. Okay.
Would you like me to say that?
Next is House Bill 2005 relating to personnel records. It has been tabled by Hank Newell. We need to take it off the table to do anything with it.
If it's done, I move it. Take House Bill 2005 from the table. It's been tabled under the House rules.
Right. Okay, Clerk Colwell.
Johnson?
No.
Tafari?
No.
Bryson?
Aye.
Shaw?
Aye.
Rogers?
Aye.
Press?
Aye. Had to go.
Chairman, I move the House Bill 2005. We don't have an amendment to it.
Mike, is there anything?
No. Maybe I should refresh it.
Yes.
Representative Kuhn asked the added amendment to delete the term letters of reference. So that's a bill. It effectively mean that an employee could look at anything in the personnel file. That amendment was voted on, I believe, and defeated.
Could you repeat that? I couldn't hear it all.
The Senator Kulongoski brought an amendment before the committee which could have deleted the word letters of reference from the bill. The effect of that it would be that an employee could look at anything in his or her personnel file. I believe that amendment was voted on and defeated.
I'm not sure that it was voted on.
Okay, then there is that possible amendment if the committee wants to consider it.
Let's clean that up.
Line 9 after United States to insert a period and delete the rest of the Senate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, well, it wasn't the list. I think it was letters of reference from previous employers. I think that was the language that was talked about being deleted.
No, then he changed it.
Yeah.
It was the whole thing.
All right.
Yeah.
That was Senator Kulongoski's amendment?
Yes.
Okay. So it reads, personnel records do not include records of an individual relating to conviction, arrest, or investigation of conduct constituting a violation of criminal laws of this state or another state or the United States. Period.
Well, that's the one that
makes
everything available.
Mm-hmm. No, that keeps these other things from the letters of reference to a problem.
No,
talking about.
I didn't write down why he suggested
it. Take care of the problem of the criminal things, so that he is basically absolved in reality on there, or is that how it's seen?
Well, the letters of reference.
Okay, they wouldn't be available for the person to see then.
No, the other way around.
They would be available.
No.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
that
isn't
him.
If you put the period in after the United States, you really restricted what do not. The things which are not included in the personnel record. And so that would make all the other things, the telephone notes, letters of reference, everything, other reports would be a part then of the personnel record. And that was where the problem
is. Conviction was related to the death.
Okay, let's get started. Did you have a motion?
I did, it won't include any amendments.
Okay, so let's get started. The motion is to move House Bill 2005 to the floor to pass as it is, right, without amendment.
He adopted it
No, it was not adopted. It was suggested, but it was not adopted. Okay, any discussion?
I think it's really going to create some problems.
I have real concerns that having been an employer that actively would have serious problems with getting information. And I think the other does more, but Kalinowski's approach does a lot more. In that for the employee, that's the important thing, is whether it does anything for the employee or not. And I think that would, that his amendment would do a lot more for the employee. Okay, any further discussion? Clerk call roll.
Johnson?
No.
Tafori?
No.
Riebel?
No.
Bryson?
No.
Starr?
Aye.
Rogers?
No.
Cliff?
Aye. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, any other preference on 2005?
Let's go Rogers. I move that House Bill 2005 be tabled.
Okay. Very motion. Let's call roll.
Johnson?
Aye.
Tafori?
Aye.
Riebel?
Aye.
Bryson?
No.
No.
Rogers?
Aye.
Cliff?
No. I think it's good, huh?
Yeah.
2673 relating to the Employment Relations Board.
Have
you seen these before, Steve?
Yeah, I'll get it now.
Okay.
Yes, I think we're cleaning up his language.
You got a
donkey? Mr. Chair, we have adopted the amendment. I think the amendment's intent was to include the deletion of
any amount of funding dollars.
No, the new language, the concept that of the which is now the language in the amendments which they just handed you. Since the committee adopted the concept that you see in the language.
What is that in the
folder? It's quite specified.
Yeah, understood. All right.
Like the word violation on line 14. I think we deleted all of section 5.
Line 23.
I don't have a hand in this package. Not given me. I don't know where they have it.
On these amendments that we have here, on the first page of the printed amendment, beginning at line 22, this is some new language. This is where we amended that.
That's on the back page, on page 3, right?
Yeah, that replaces this. This right here replaces this. That down here. That up there, we say the death.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's the same as death.
If you're looking at the new amendment that I handed you this evening, line 22 and 26 on the first page of line 22 with the story of the second page, replace that insert on the hand there with the line.
Yes.
On page 4, the second insert. Deals with the bonding requirement.
That reads, money complaints. Okay. These new amendments, they don't make reference to the deletion of section 5, do they?
Yes. Page 2.
Oh, so we're on the last item.
Okay, right.
Okay. Let me read it. Now, I'll read this aloud here. When a complainant requests the issuance of a temporary cease and desist order under subsection 1 of this section, and that's section 3 of the printed bill, then before issuing the order, the board shall require the complainant to give an undertaking with one or more corporate sureties approved by the board. The undertaking shall be on an amount specified by the board and shall provide that the complainant will pay, and I've circled the word 2, I had written in mine here, in, the word in, an amount not exceeding the amount of the undertaking. The actual damages of the person restrained by the order should the issuance of the order be wrongful or without sufficient cost.
And two is right.
And it would be in an amount.
No, because that's the ultimate. In an amount means one number. Two in amount means up to.
Maybe we should say up to an amount.
Yeah.
Do we need to say up to an amount?
Right. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's what was indicated the other day when Joel was the ultimate. He was up to.
Yeah. Okay, well, no objection to insert up to.
Okay. The actual damages of the person restrained by the other should be issued. Okay. Alright, so that checks with what we have done before. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering is.
It's an amount not exceeding the limit up to.
Well, right. I don't think we need up or two.
No.
There's no objection. We'll delete up
and
two.
That comma.
We'll
pay an amount not exceeding the amount.
And so, provided that the complainant will pay an amount not exceeding the amount of the undertaking.
We need the comma.
We'll
pay the actual damages. So it's will pay to an amount not exceeding the amount of the undertaking. The actual damages.
Well, you don't need that. You don't need up for two. See?
On the first page?
No, second page.
Yeah,
it's,
you've
got to
have a
preposition
in there.
To an amount,
huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually,
yeah,
what's the two's in there?
Yeah.
I'll get it. Okay.
Okay.
Put it all back in there, man.
They have enough
English
pieces on
there. The request Mr. Gilbert asked you was to make two sentences out of an extremely long sentence. And he came up with two sentences, but they're not perhaps the most flowing sentence.
All right. Okay, so we do need up to?
No.
The amount is an amount specified by the board, which may be less than the actual damages. So I think the intent that Joe had was to say up to an amount, but not exceeding, setting a lid on it. Or if you were to say an amount not exceeding, it may be vague as to whether or not that amount could be something lower. I think it just makes it clearer with the language up to in it.
It's always dangerous to a man sitting up here, but I'll tell you, this thing is bad. And I'm wondering if we should read it. Will pay the actual damages of the person restrained by the other, comma, not exceeding the amount of the undertaking, comma, should the issuance of the order be wrongful or without sufficient cost.
I think it's easier if you say up to but not exceeding.
The complainant will pay the actual damages of the person restrained by the order, comma, not exceeding the amount of the undertaking, comma, should the issuance of the order be wrongful or without sufficient cost.
Okay. Yes, and just continue, son.
How
about that, Mike?
That's a bad.
Could be easier.
Yeah, and shall provide that the complainant will pay, forget the commas, will pay the actual damages of the person restrained by the order, comma, not exceeding the amount of the undertaking, comma, should the issuance of the order be wrongful or without sufficient cause.
Yeah. Okay. No objections to that amendment?
Okay. Because that provides it shall not exceed the amount of the bond, and it also provides that it would be the actual damage, as long as it didn't exceed the amount. And if anyone ever wants to argue about that in court, we've labored over it long ago.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, let's go to get into the point of voting on this. I'm going to miss part of the testimony on this thing. Has there ever been any demonstrated need for this at all by anybody before this committee?
Yeah, Susan, you want to...
I must have missed it. I would have remembered if she had spoken.
Oh, no. Yes, it's a good
example. Identify yourself,
please. I'm Susan Ruth, ADHL-CIO. Roger Brandon goes with you, and Roger's Dick House, who Roger Brandon goes with the firefighters. Dick House is a, oh dear, his local escapes me. And they had specific instances within their unions where this issuance of a temporary cease and desist would have greatly alleviated from the suffering that was taken up during the interim while the ERB was gathering information in order to make the final decision. And that is where this has come from. I might add that this bill comes out of the Court Standing Committee on Public Employees, I'm sorry, of the 77 Cope Convention.
You said it came out of what now?
Of the Cope Standing Committee for Public Employees.
I'm not used to all the acronyms yet, you'll have to forgive me.
When we were testifying for it, I didn't have any specific examples as far as situations. I was not familiar with them. They had several instances that they were referring to, and they did not submit written testimony.
Cope is
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Okay, thanks for the
discussion. You didn't say that you started it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we still got to get there, right?
For the record, I'm Steve Telfer here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, and Oregon School Boards Association. We're essentially opposed to the bill conceptually because it involves providing an administrative agency with temporary cease and desist powers, which we don't think are appropriate. That's really something the courts ought to be doing, but as I pointed out in my testimony the other day on the bill, there were a number of concerns we had. I think that the draft you have before you, should it be your wish to proceed with the bill, is much cleaner and at least resolves most of the concerns I had, the technical concerns I had with the bill. I'm not aware, Representative Johnson, of any specific examples at all where I didn't know or think of the normal process of getting any concern. I can suspect that it would be arising out of an unfair labor practice charge where perhaps there was a charge of not bargaining in good faith or perhaps not living up to the terms of an agreement, and the investigation period that ERB would undertake could be protracted enough that perhaps the temporary cease and desist order might bring about a quicker resolution of the problem. But I'm not aware of any specific example.
But you did appear before this committee then at some time when I wasn't here, because
there was a specific example, I'm not sure of the names or the people that were involved, that was 6 months at the time of the informal labor practice until the final decision was made by the ERB, at which time the informal labor practice continued, and it was severely, as I understand it, detrimental to the parties concerned. And that type of thing.
What kind of damages occurred?
Economic damage.
In what way? They didn't get a raise, or what did happen? They didn't get a raise, or did they actually were laid off, or what did happen?
In that specific instance, sir, I'm not clear exactly on the details on that one.
That big passage thing?
Yeah.
I mean, officials, but I try to be at these meetings, and I, for some reason, I just escaped me. I rarely ever heard anything that even indicated any of the bill.
That's
Tim Rogers. I'm just trying to follow along.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to talk about Section 3. We're talking about public employees. Collective bargaining. Section 3, it assesses a civil fine. It says any person who violates shall pay a civil fine, a civil penalty, in an amount determined by the board of not more than $1,000 for each offense. I don't think you ever did really get an answer of who this person is. And I presume that in the generic term, that is the school board of the city council or whomever. Now, they cannot be held personally liable by actions they have taken in good faith unless they do certain things. So it would have to be that public body that would be penalized this amount. And I've got a real problem with fining a body that the money is some people in the taxes. I think a writ of mandamus which requires the performance is appropriate, and I've just got a real problem with this civil penalty. And I think that question was asked and was never really answered when we heard this before. Because this direct, it mandates it. They have no choice but to order or to issue this temporary cease and desist order. Now, of course, the bond that is put up by the party that's requesting the issuance of the temporary cease and desist order is in the, I think, what the overall effect of this might be in the long run is that no one will ever request one under this statute. And if they did, it would have to be issued. It's just got to be a better way to handle this kind of a problem. And I understand the problem if someone's without a paycheck because they've been fired or quit through an unfair labor practice situation where they're without pay.
And you're saying you don't have redress now in any form?
Well,
that's the bottom
line,
right?
I'm not sure.
I was under the impression that they had redress if they didn't already.
They may ultimately get paid. If someone has been
dismissed
or refused promotion or whatever it would be, which would constitute an unfair labor practice, ultimately they may prevail on the court or at ERB or the court and get the back pay, but they're without pay during that period of time.
Is this the example that he gave?
Now, that's the problem. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. I guess.
Do you have some other method of going into this? Could you have used some other means to get something more prompt action? Under the current law?
That's where the hang-up is.
Trying to speed up the process, but it was left out there dangling for months. By the way, you were here because in a minute you asked Mr. Cleveland a question. I just don't remember that thing at all.
I think we were not really given very much specifics.
Because I don't think anybody even shows specifics, and that has me bad, as I cannot recall hearing any specifics that nobody has any records. In testimony from Roger Brandenburg from the firefighters, no specific cases.
Yeah, I don't think any of them did.
That's what brought me to ask the question.
Yeah, I think more than anything else, that there may be some cases that have prevented that it's prevented more than anything else.
Okay, what's the committee's pleasure here? We have a marked up bill at least, right? Okay, let me move to expedite matters. I'll move the amendments to House Bill 2673 as they have been presented. I will include Representative Rogers' recommendations on the changes on page 2 of the bill stated 4379.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question now. In the calendar, it doesn't show this as being tabled, but according to my record, I'm here in the Board of Science Committee, it's 428 is
tabled. 28, yes, that's right.
Okay.
We better watch this, make sure that we're. Okay, then we'll have to watch table on the evening. Then we have to.
Mr. Chairman, could we not do that until we find out if it's really needed? I mean, I'm just going through my notes too, and I guess I have problems with. If we can't get any more specific, then just. If there's any precedent for this kind of.
I think the intent was more to be more preventive than anything else. I can't find any cases specific. Do you have any specific cases that weren't presented?
They were not presented, but I know that there are some, and I can have suggestions for you.
Yeah,
I don't know. Okay, if there are cases where there are abuses, I certainly would support that. There are problems. Don, do you have any? The system works so well now, I'm really reluctant to change it.
I would disagree with you there,
I've only been involved about 6 years, I think, to start in the process in direct negotiations, and it isn't that bad, the system they have.
I guess it's a difference.
If there is a difference whether you're involved or not, that's true.
Okay, can you give us specific cases? Okay. Now the bill is tabled. It will still remain tabled. I don't know when I'll get to it, but.
Are we agreeing?
Yeah. Huh? No, we're just going to be able to stop for a while. That's all.
Finally died, that's
it. Okay, we'll be on the next. We can even talk about it. Okay. 2726.
Lombard Amendment to this bill. Actually, find that folder here, which the members voted on and was defeated. The I can review the amendment again. Line 33 of the printed bill, after transportation insert for hire, after vehicle delete the rest of the line. Line 34, delete gravel, sand, dirt, or asphalt concrete.
Okay, so that means anybody drives a truck for hire?
Yes.
Okay. And that was the CD, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so we have the road and the original bill before us, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Any other wishes for this man?
Okay,
that's all right, that's me too.
Mr. Chairman?
Sam Rogers.
I'd move the amendment to Justin Webb on lines 33 and 34, page 2 of the bill.
Okay, these are the ones that were removed before, but were defeated, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, Rob Bell?
Pardon me,
what did you say?
He moved the amendment proposed by Rustin Lombard.
So we're splitting the line 33 and 34 of the.
Anybody drives truck?
Then transportation motor vehicle, and who both furnishes and maintains the vehicle used in such transportation.
Okay, so that would include a cab driver, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We hear the motion. I intend to hire it because the hired. I'm supposed to oppose it because that unit goes so broad.
Yeah, it is.
Clerk Carville.
Johnson?
Aye.
McCoy?
No.
Riebel?
Aye.
Bryson?
No.
Dodd?
No.
Rogers?
Aye.
Chris?
No.
Fail.
Okay, the amendment failed. So any other motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Rogers?
I move House Bill 2726 to carry to be passed.
Okay, is there any discussion? Clerk Carville.
Johnson?
Aye.
McCoy?
No.
Riebel?
Aye.
Bryson?
No.
Dodd?
No.
Rogers?
Roger. Okay, that's 2-3.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay. Let me that one.
Yeah. Okay. 27-26 is done with. 4-5. 27-6.
Isn't that Roger preparing?
Yeah.
That is. Okay.
What's next? 2713.
Mm-hmm. So that would mean that any
I think it was tabled after 5 o'clock tonight.
Aye.
So, if you're going to say, let's have a motion to take it off. Okay, let's go, Roger, move to the house.
No.
Well, that's from
staff.
Sorry.
There is a difference.
No. No. No.
Hi.
No.
Roger.
No. Hi. You must be outside. Okay. Moving on now.
Emergency cars on the lot. Okay.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you one quote, because none of that corrected.
No, no, you're looking at the wrong quote. Let me walk you through just the type sheet.
Alright, okay.
And this becomes an entire new section, so you can, you don't have to worry about where it actually fits into the printed book.
Okay.
The existing language on page 1 of the proposed amendment, the existing language remains the same until down toward the bottom of the page, regulations is deleted and the word rules is inserted in two lines. Then on page 2, sub B, the all of that part is deleted. And then there is new language which says the maximum weekly benefit amount shall be, and that will be 55% up to June 30th, 1971. And the language in between there doesn't have a great deal of meaning. That just carries it until June 30th of this year. And then the sub B, it would step up to 57.5% of the state average weekly covered wage by the preceding calendar year, effective by the benefit years for the week that includes July the 4th of 1979, and through any benefit year commencing with the week which includes June 28th, 1980. Now, the June 28th here is the simple correction we have made with this. And then at that point, in that week, comes sub C, it grew to 65% of the state average weekly covered wage for the preceding calendar year, effective for any benefit year commencing with and after the week which includes July the 4th, 1980, and the week which includes each July 4th thereafter. Now, Ron, I'd ask a question at this point. Do you have $119 for maximum benefit currently? That's based on the 55% of average weekly wage. Do you have the figure on what you expect it to go to July the 4th of this year, sitting at 55%?
Let me search a little bit.
Okay. If you don't have it close at hand, do you have the, let's see, on this fiscal impact, it didn't, but then it will increase because the average weekly wage would increase, and then it would increase an additional 2.5%. What I was leading up to is you have the step that you expect that the benefit would increase to.
The increase of 65% would be an increase of 9.79% of the current level.
On the same average weekly wage, that would be about a $12 a week increase.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that'd take it up to about $130 a week.
I'm sorry, I don't have that exactly for you.
When there are no other changes in existing law on page 3, and on page 4, it's simply a renumbering of sections.
Right.
With the exception of
the emergency.
Of section 4 would be the emergency.
Right.
the six landmarks is west, and this would be that the two portions is built together, and these amendments were adopted would be.
The fiscal impact of the two amendments together would be a decrease in benefits of in the $7 million one dollar $46,919,900. That's arrived at by, I assume you have our preliminary unofficial impact statement before you. By adding the $35 million to the $29 million on one of the really two and three under effect on expenses, and subtracting the $17 million, you arrive at the $46 million on the top line. So a decrease in benefits would be a total of $46,919,000.
So the effect would have, if this is amended, would be that those people who left a job without this card, and we were all given that your proposed rules on the good cause. Anyone who left work without good cause would not be able to draw unemployment compensation unless they re-qualified by owning an amount equal to or greater than the amount of the benefit for 4 weeks. And then they could qualify for unemployment compensation.
That's correct. Now, it does not apply only to voluntary leaving. It also applies to discharge and refusal of suitable work. To refusal of suitable work. Refusal of work.
But that's discharge for good cause.
For discharge and misconduct connected with work.
Yeah.
But again, the comment just before that, again, I didn't quite hear it either. I want to make sure it's on the record.
I'm sorry, would you repeat the question, Mr. Chairman?
It was your comment, but it did more than affect those that,
yeah,
that quit.
The bill is written in effect all those who are disqualified under Section 176 of OS 657, which would include voluntary leaving, discharge misconduct, failure to accept suitable work and offer, failure referral, that type of thing.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2030 be amended by the proposed House amendment that was supplied by the Employment Division.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Clerk Carwell.
Johnson?
You're talking about the Rogers Employment Division. Okay, yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Weevil?
Aye.
Rison?
Aye.
Starr?
No.
Rogers?
Aye.
Fett?
No. Okay, they passed, right?
Chairman?
Yes. What's that?
Move the Table Bill 2848.
Okay, let's turn Star News to Table House Bill 2848. Okay, close Star.
Johnson?
No.
Corey?
Aye.
Weevil?
No.
Bryson?
Aye.
Star?
Aye.
Rogers?
No.
Fred?
Aye. Okay. Come on. That was a good turn. There were at least two members that wanted a little more of an explanation from the Employment Division as to how this would affect people who were actually at work and attending school, and they didn't want them to qualify down there. The question they had, Ron, was
there was an honest concern about their safety. You're enrolled in college, you're holding down a job. We don't want to disqualify from collecting unemployment insurance. And we wanted to be reassured as to how they would be taken care of through either by virtue of having this law come into effect and then by the rules that you actually passed.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Ron Moore, Assistant Minister of Employment Division, John Payne Insurance. As I understand House Bill 2804, this would actually push back to the policy that we had in the Employment Division.
Ron, excuse me. Before we go on, this thing's been tabled off automatically out.
Okay.
So why don't we have the motion to take it off the table so we can get it before us?
Okay.
We will move to take off the table and move to the House Bill 2804.
All right.
Is there any objection? None. Now we.
Ron Moore, Assistant Minister of Employment Division for Employment Insurance. The bill that's proposed would actually set us back to where we were a number of years ago for the greatest period of time in the history of the program. The burden of proof on the student was that that student proved that they were actually in the labor force and available for work. As a result, and we had a number of court decisions that supported that position. We had two court decisions that have turned that around somewhat. The first of it was the Petrel case, which in a sense said that the student was not presumed to be unavailable for work. Because of that, the burden of proof has been upon the agency to prove the student was unavailable for work, rather than upon the student to prove that he or she was available for work. The situation would be that kind of all kinds of gray areas, but some factual situations would be someone who was a student, was working full time, was laid off for lack of work, like the other members of that particular employees of that employer. There'd probably be no question about that individual being paid a fair debt and returned to work days. Now, if you have a situation where someone, say, is working a graveyard shift for an employer, and the majority of the employees in that particular labor market work all shifts, and plus primarily day shifts, that particular student was unable or unwilling to rearrange their hours to be available for all shifts, we would probably find that person not qualified. It would be up to the student to come in and prove to us, to overcome this presumption, that he or she was actually in the labor force, was willing to take the jobs customary to that particular occupation, and the burden of proof would be on the individual. Present time, as I say, the result of court decisions, the burden of proof is on the agency. It makes it rather difficult to prove it, but I guess it really boils down to a matter of public policy. Should the burden of proof be on the agency? Should the burden of proof be on the student?
Mr. Chairman?
Some job.
Could you say, in effect, and fairly, that no one who is entitled to benefits would be losing those, but potentially it would solve an abuse by putting this bill into effect, a potential abuse? Would it be anybody who wouldn't rightfully be refused, or who would rightfully be refused benefits?
Representative, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I'll do the best I can. I suppose it depends upon a subjective thing as to you know, what abuse is and whether it should rise.
Using the standards before the court case that you're describing, or the standards you use to establish full-time students, would anyone be, in effect, refused benefits if this bill were passed?
Yes, people would be refused benefits, yes.
But for what reason, now, to say that?
If the
full-time is what we're saying.
Okay. If they fail to overcome the presumption, and let's go back to a case where an individual was in the third year of college, and the case went to court. The individual was paying, as I recall, 19 term hours, had a history of working full-time and going to college. In the third year of college, filed a claim. We found that individual, at that time, we had a presumption it was in effect by policy, not by law, but by policy. We found the individual did not overcome the presumption. They went to court, and the individual prevailed in court. And the court of appeals overturned our decision and said that the individual should be paid benefits. That was in third year of college. The following year, fourth year of college, same student, same situation, same unemployment. Again, we felt this time the presumption was even more difficult to overcome, being in the fourth year and more unlikely that the individual would drop school if offered suitable employment. Same individual, same court, same everything. And this time the court determined that individual did not overcome the presumption that should be disqualified. So, in one case, in the third year of college, felt that yes, the individual probably would drop school. In the fourth year of college, the court determined that the individual probably would not. A reasonable, prudent person probably would not at that point in their educational career drop college.
So then it would be fair to say that, on a basis of equity, that if this bill passed, that we are not going to be adversely affecting anyone who legitimately would be entitled to benefits, and we possibly would.
Okay. In my judgment, that statement is correct, Representative.
Okay, I just want to be sure.
I had a bill drafted, as most people probably know, that was really the opposite language, saying that the full-time student was not a presumption or a reason to deny, automatically disqualify a person from unemployment, and it's in the Senate, so I didn't put it in. I haven't heard yet any examples of where you're not being able to get the person disqualified. Now, this student, if he or she had been working all this length of time and was in the third year of school, I don't care how many hours it is, I mean, there are people that really can do that. That sounded like a good decision after a certain point, if they still haven't gotten a job, and that's a whole other story. Probably they should be disqualified, but I guess the evidence hasn't come clear to me yet that you're not being able to get at the people abusing the system. And all of us have sort of a vague notion that there are all these kids out there ripping off the unemployment system and going to school full time. And Bill probably knows one, and Al knows two or three. And I just don't think that's enough reason to change the whole presumption of the statute.
Representative, there are two basic kinds of problems. One is that we are unable to find out who's going to school. The honor roll was published from one school, was published in the newspaper, and only showing names. We have an alphabetical way of getting at that, so we got at the Social Security numbers that way. Ran a cross-check and found a surprising number of those who were telling us that they were not going to school, and actually were going to school, and were on the honor roll.
Did you automatically disqualify them for falsifying their
That's misrepresentation. That's true if we can find out. But the problem is that the president privacy rule.
People are working and they're falsifying. I don't understand why you're targeting the students.
If they're working and drawing an appointment, we find them. Because the employers report their wage records every quarter. The cross match says 100% by computer. we find those. We don't find the student who's going to school and going on a plane at the same time.
Is that because it's already difficult to keep your unemployment while you're a student? And I don't understand why they would falsify those records if it is, in fact, even...
They falsify the records because, of course, they want the unemployment insurance money. And there's no way to cross that because of the privacy, and it's required by federal law. There's no way to get at
that. That's why I asked the question, Gretchen, was, is anybody going to be hurt? And as he said, there isn't anybody going to be hurt who has a legitimate claim to the benefits. And I think I got that out. And that was my basic concern. We just are, if we don't do that, it seems it could be a lot of payoff. That's where I'd be at.
Yeah. Ron, let me ask a couple of questions here. Okay, you've got an individual who is working 6 hours a night tending bar in a pizza joint, 5 days a week, and they get laid off. An individual working 6 hours, 5 days a week, 30 hours a week, $3 an hour. They get laid off. Would they be entitled to unemployment insurance?
I would say sure. I don't think there's any particular problem there, and especially if their normal trade is some other hours or whatever, or if they can make any kind of arrangements at all, or indicate with any kind of credibility that they can change their schedule or job skill or whatever.
I'm not talking about anybody in school. I'm talking about an individual who happens to work 6 hours a week, or 6 hours a night, 5 days a week, $3 an hour.
Okay.
Slinging pizzas and pouring beer. And that's it. And they're laid off. Would they be entitled to unemployment?
Yeah.
Now, if
they're buying an ETA requirement.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, let's say that individual also went to school full time.
Mm-hmm.
And was laid off, would they be then entitled to unemployment insurance under the existing law?
Under the existing law, yes, right. I would think so. There could be situations that would pair that, but I would say basically yes.
Okay, and they would continue on as a full-time student while they're looking for another job to replace the one that they were just laid off from.
Right.
The problem is that when you come and you ask them, are you a full-time student? What happens? And that's what happens, isn't it? You ask them if they're a full-time student.
Yeah, you ask them each on each certification, are they attending school?
Right.
Yes or no.
And if they say no.
And the problem is, they say no.
Okay, and if they said that they were.
Okay, if they said they were, then we would gather the information regarding their attendance to school. And if it did not appear that they're attached to the labor market, they would be paid.
Okay. Now, if they said that they weren't attending school, then what would happen?
They'd probably never find out,
one way or the other. One way or the other, you would never find out.
Yeah, probably either way, you'd probably never find out. That's right.
Okay, so you've got one individual who's working 30 hours a week, slinging pizza and pouring beer, and going to school 6 to 8 hours a day. 5 days a week. And if that person gets laid off, they're entitled to unemployment insurance.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, you say probably. Now, what would be criteria? But I mean, but in and of itself, it has nothing to do with the fact that they're going to school. Right?
Well, okay. If they're in some occupation where they need to be available more than just evening, and the school is during the day, then we would look to see, are they substantially restricting the attachment labor market by restricting the available hours to evening shifts? If that's the case, then we'd probably find them unavailable for work.
Evenings and weekends or something like that.
Yeah.
Even in that case,
the school
could be too restricted.
Right.
Okay. And then you would say that they weren't entitled.
If there's someone with an occupation normally worked 8 to 5, for instance, and they were going to school evenings, there would be no problem. That would not interfere with their attachment to the labor market. On the other hand, if they went to school
during the day and work in the evening, but primarily their occupation work during the daytime, and they were unwilling to make a change in their school attendance, then we would probably find they were unreasonably restricting the taxes labor force. Okay.
But if most beer and most pizzas are sold in the evening, right?
Well, the meal arrives in the
morning. What I'm trying to get at here is most students do things like, just like I described. I mean, I watch a paper chase. I know what the kid does there, right? Okay. Some work for the legislature. They do those kind. Most students do those kinds of jobs, I believe. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a
stereotype,
but I think that's the kind of a job, if they're going to be working and working to the amount necessary, that's the kind of job they'd be having. And so they wouldn't be limiting themselves, would they? Because most of that kind of work takes place in the evening or on weekends or whatever. So it boils down to that individual could, in fact, qualify for unemployment insurance even though they're a student full time.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we're talking about is a student that's not working, that isn't working, wants unemployment, and says, I'm not a student. And that's the person that's getting this, is escaping out there someplace, right?
You can't find them. Okay, those are the kind that we can't find. Now, there are really two categories. One we can't find.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt we'll be able to find no matter what we do here. The second thing are those who are telephone students.
Okay.
And the burden of proof is upon the agency to prove they are not available for work rather than they are. The question is, which way should it be?
Now, so on the one hand, we have a student, a full-time student, who's working and could very well qualify for unemployment insurance. On the other hand, we have a chief. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But with this language in this bill, it would say even that person now that would qualify would not qualify.
I don't believe that's
on a full-time basis shall be presumed unavailable for work within the meaning of this section.
And that's the rebuttable prevention. If they can come and indicate that they are an active member of the labor market, they would be free.
Rebuttable prevention.
That's why I asked the question.
Be presumed in itself means it's a rebuttable presumption?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
That's why I asked the question the way I did.
Okay.
We have the same fact.
Go ahead.
Please come back. You said several years ago. Now let's go back. How many years ago? 77, 76?
Oh, 76.
Besides the past year, we didn't say all the kids. Okay. All right. Let me. Because 1975, I went through the exercise that Representative Confori was talking about because of someone who was on a shift where warehouses shut down a whole shift for a short while, and he was told that he could not draw unemployment compensation. I discussed it with the folks up here because I had a bill already dropped in, and someone down in the field office was a little bit in error, and they got that resolved.
Right.
Because you treat people in a different category if they are temporarily laid off with an expectation of going back to work. Now, they still have to be available for work, but they don't have to search as hard. That's what it goes on.
That's basically true. I think the other thing, if I remember the situation correctly, all the mills were shut down at that time in the area, so it didn't matter whether they were involved with day shift, evening shift, or whatever.
But what had alarmed him, and in turn alarmed me, was we were told that since he was going to school full time, that he was not going to draw unemployment compensation.
Yes.
But then that was an error on someone's part.
Well, I recall there was a misunderstanding in the local office on that.
Right. All right. Now, this bill would return it to the situation that existed until last year when the petrol case was decided. And so,
I'm here saying on the term last year, it was recently, yes, but I'm not sure it was last year. I'm trying to
remember. 77 or
78. Yes, it was recently.
Yeah, I had a problem with this until I wanted to be very sure of what this meant because of that previous experience and your concern. And so as long as we're going back to what it was before that court decision, based on my knowledge of dealing with the system for some people, I've got no problem.
I have one more question. You spend more time, if you know, figure that, let's assume everyone's honest, and they put, yes, I'm a student, but I've been laid off or whatever. You spend more time checking out a person who's marked student on their form than you would, say, when I was on unemployment, when I was in. It was a real rubber stamp thing, as far as I was concerned.
Yes, let's try to draw some parallels. Let's say the waitress comes in and indicates that he or she is available only for day shift. We spend time with that individual to decide, you know, in your labor market, are restaurants open more than just day shift? And in most cases, they are. So we spend the time with that person. Now, with students, we have enough of those that we have a special form that they complete. Nothing magic about it except that the volume.
More time checking out whether they are in fact available and looking and ready and all those criteria?
Not any more than we would on anyone else where an eligibility issue arose. But since the volume is there, we do have a form. Form type of questionnaire because it's more cost effective to do it that way. Now, if we had thousands of waitresses with that kind of situation, we'd have a special form for that individual to fill out. But that's really the only difference. We spend no more time with one. In fact, probably because of the frequency of it and the fact we have a special form for it, probably reduces the time. That's the only reason we have a special form to reduce the time.
From that one situation you talked about, the student in the third year and the same student in the fourth year, same circumstance, that would indicate really that student went to school during the summertime, and then when the new school year started and there was a conflict between the job and the school, the job had to be given up. Because otherwise, if it's just a layoff of some kind, the same incident probably would not have occurred with the same individual.
I'm going to try remembering exactly what the separation situation was in that case, representing you, but you're probably correct. Yeah. An example would be someone, for instance, who was going to law school and it was just a very close to finishing law school and they both take the bar exam. The probability of them dropping out at that point would be rather slim, and we would look very closely at that person.
But how would this bill change that?
You probably, on the law students, you probably should look at them more closely in the first term, because that's the one they've got to go full time at the University of Oregon.
Unless they were, for example, written notes as our chairman indicated, then there wouldn't be any problem again. I can remember a case where someone was working and going to school during the daytime. And they lost their job. But they were working as a baker's assistant, baker's helper. And that job is primarily a nighttime job. You know, you don't find any baker's helpers working during daytime. And so, you know, that was a fairly easy one to clear. It's just a matter of common sense, I guess, and what makes sense.
I just haven't heard it.
Okay, I think we... What's going to be the new House Bill 2804 or 24 GPAT?
Discussion? Clerk call roll.
Johnson?
Aye.
Kapori?
No.
Riegel?
Aye.
Bryson?
Aye.
Starr?
No.
Rogers?
Aye.
Yes.
No.
That's that. All you want. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see. House Bill 312, Little David Baker.
Chairman?
Please table House Bill 312. Okay, let's turn to the table House Bill 312. Let's follow. No.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. We'll now take about a 5 minute recess.
No, I said I wanted to read stuff. I want to learn the book. You've got 2 seconds of this stuff. How do I know anything about it? I'm not going to ask that.
Okay, the discussions have been on the preponderance of some form of House Bill. That's very nice, but he's pushing for some language, and what we're going to do now. The employment division is trying to work out some language relating to. To unemployment insurance for some category or whatever of either those subject to lockout, strike, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to work out some language now. What I intend to do now, as committee members know, we'll be on the workers' comp stuff starting Wednesday. We're going to go Wednesday night. We'll go Friday afternoon on the description of the bill that we're proposing. Friday, some invited testimony, and then Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I would think of next week, work session. Next Monday night, I intend to use Monday night to take care of any other bills unrelated to workers' comp. For a Monday night hearing or a work session of the week from Monday. So it'll be okay, so it'll be a week from tonight. We'll come back with this bill and maybe a couple of others. We've got one other one, Senate bill, I think, that we can schedule and a couple others for next Monday night. So that's as far as we go tonight. I think we cleaned up a few, and we are adjourned. Oh, Al, do you want to. Did you talk to everybody about the safety net?
I'll talk to Max, so that's fine.
Okay, fine. All right.